Down with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The hour on this, the 17th day of July, 2014. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That, of course, is where you go if you want to jump into the chat room, where we have a Jim Dandy good time most every evening during the hours in which the program is live. That'll be the hours of 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. If you come by, registration is free and dadgummit, it's easy, and well, why not? Go ahead, come by, enjoy the entire multimedia real-time experience that is The Horn. We've got a friendly gang that hangs out there most every evening and who will make you quite welcome. Yeah, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll also find the pop-out player for your listening via PC or laptop needs. If you want to listen via an iDevice, a smart device, a tablet this, or a phone that, well, we recommend the apps from TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio. They work quite nicely. Of course, the podcast is always available under the subdomain for me, Bob Kincaid. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Okie doke? Yeah. It is, the 17th of July, 2014. Ordinarily, such days as this are simply referred to as Thorn in the Side Thursday. Somehow or another, though, and I don't mean to put too grim a point on it, somehow or another, though, this feels rather unlike a thorn and a hell of a lot more like a stiletto. We hear often from our good friend Bill, Mr. Stress, in Cleveland, who has a historical interest in the happenings on this planet about 100 revolutions of the sun ago. And today was a day to make you feel particularly like that might be, well, an appropriate fascination. Yes, indeed. And we'll be talking about that at greater length within the context of the program. Right now, however, I will remind you that this is all listener-supported radio. And if you wish to be a part of helping to keep The Horn going, well, we try to raise $150 per evening. And thanks to Jan and Jerry in Nevada, that's been reduced. And thanks to Thomas last night and Sal, that's been reduced to $85 for this evening. We can write eight folks, nine folks at $10 a piece, and we'll be done with fundraising for the evening. So consider that. It is about 5 minutes past the hour, and I was tickled to have a conversation earlier today online with second congressional district candidate, independent candidate for Congress, Ed Rabel. Ed has a new book out, and Ed, it will very soon be certified to be on the ballot for the November general election. And it's a candidacy I personally welcome, because there's not much in the way of choice for people of conscience other than Ed. So with that in mind, we're going to be talking with Ed here just in a couple of minutes. Ed is also an author, among other things. He's an Emmy Award-winning news journalist, television journalist with a long career covering various and sundry stories in the far-flung reaches beyond the United States. But as an author, he has a new book out, Black Gold, Black Death. And it is a thriller, I think one could say. Would we call it a thriller, Ed?
Yeah, it's sort of a metaphor, Bob, for all of the problems that have afflicted West Virginia as a result of mountaintop removal and black lung disease and cancer rates rising. It's a metaphor for the rotten underbelly of coal here in our state. So it's black gold, black death. In coal country, America's president is marked for assassination. It's fiction, obviously, but, you know, the palpable hatred of the president in the southern coal fields, I write about that in this book.
Well, I was wondering how fictionalized it really is, because there are a lot of people who harbor downright violent feelings about President Obama in this state, much to my chagrin and horror.
Yeah, not only do they harbor it, but they speak it out loud. I mean, they make no bones about it. They'd like to see the president dead.
Without giving away the contents of the book, do you offer any understanding, Ed, for where this comes from? I mean, is it just plain old-fashioned bare-bones racism, or what?
Well, I think that's part of it. I also think that, this notion that Obama is engaged in a war on coal is flat out ridiculous, and it's both deceitful and dishonest, I think, for people, especially politicians, and you know who I'm talking about, politicians who pander to the fears of the people by suggesting that if the EPA were to go away tomorrow, that somehow coal would come bounding back.
Yes.
Well, the truth of it is, in 1948, there were 126,000 miners in our state. Today, there are fewer than 21,000 miners. And the reason for that is not because of the EPA. The decline in coal mining employment began long before the EPA was invented. It began long before the Clean Air Act was instituted. And the reality is, the coal industry itself has declared war on the coal miners, and the way they did it was by mechanizing and modernizing how they mine coal. And also, it's cheaper to mine coal out west, and all over the country, communities are going for natural gas power plants as opposed to coal-fired power plants. So this notion, you know, but the people have been fed a line, the coal miners particularly, by big coal and by their apologists, like Capito and Tennant and my opponents in this race, Mooney and Casey,
right,
that somehow Obama is waging a war on coal. And so that's in part where it concerns also racism. You're right.
Well, it also seems quite intractable, at least where this state is concerned, Ed. Now you just mentioned four political names in this state, namely Shelley Moore Capito, who, of course, is the daughter of Arch, who was the single most corrupt Republican governor the state has ever known. You mentioned Natalie Tennant, who is the sitting Secretary of State, who is running against her. They're both running for Jay Rockefeller's soon-to-be-vacant Senate seat. Nick Casey is a former head of the West Virginia Democratic Party and close intimate of Joe Manchin. And Nick Mooney, well, I don't know how to begin to describe him, except to say that, as folks who you and I know talk like this say, he ain't from around here. And you know, he's all fascinated with making sure women can't get access to contraception and all manner of bizarre things. And he hates the fact that people can go to the doctor when they're sick. You, of course, had mentioned in your own right mountaintop removal. which, you know, as a broadcaster, I've spent more time on air talking about that particular practice than any other broadcast on earth. What is it about mountaintop removal that A, makes them so shy to talk about it, and you so insistent that it must be discussed?
Well, first of all, I am for a moratorium on any new mountaintop removal, or for that matter, hydraulic fracturing or fracking, as it's called, because, 500 mountains in America have been destroyed by mountaintop removal, and all 500 of them are right here in West Virginia. Of course, the reason those politicians whose names you just mentioned, the reason they shy away is because of the notion that I think, by the way, is unfounded, quite frankly. But the reason is they believe that to speak ill of coal in West Virginia is doomsday. In other words, you cannot oppose coal or the coal industry and big coal, and for that matter, the legacy of coal and the coal culture without defeating yourself. And so what I found, though, honestly, in gathering the 2,269 signatures that were required to get me on the ballot, and by the way, the Secretary of State just today confirmed that I have gotten the requisite number of signatures to put me on the ballot, and so therefore I definitely will be on the ballot in November. But what I have found from talking to the voters is that they are disgusted with this idea, and they are disgusted with the politicians who are pandering to the fears of the people. They're tired of the gridlock in Washington, and they want to change, and they're really looking to a third candidate, and I hope that I meet their needs. But they, I hear the same kinds of things that you have been speaking about on Facebook, and also in your piece that was so spot on about this entire issue of the failure of Tennant in particular to not be simply Capito light or trying to out Capito Capito. You're dead on, spot on that, but they honestly feel that, and to some extent they're right about it, speaking against coal is politically dynamite, and so they shy away from it.
Well, if you don't mind, Ed, I'd like to explore that a little bit.
Sure.
I've seen over the course of the last 5, 6, 7 years. A good handful of polls, and one of them in particular was quite interesting. I think the Sierra Club, actually, the Beyond Coal campaign, commissioned it. And when they commissioned it, they went to great pains to hire both a Republican polling company and a Democratic polling company because they wanted to get some, methodologies always differ in any polls, and it's an art and not a science. So they wanted to get both ends of the spectrum. And in West Virginia, the numbers came back shockingly similar.
Right.
And that is that not just a plurality, but a majority of West Virginians oppose mountaintop removal.
Exactly.
If that is the case, then I think we're going to have to do a little more psychological examination, perhaps is a good phrase, on this issue. Is it that people oppose it, but they've got some sort of fatalistic vision about the power of the coal industry? Is that it? Or they're okay opposing it as long as they don't have to put their names to it? Or do they really oppose it, and might they actually support a candidate who speaks truth to power, for lack of a better phrase, and wants to do something about it? I mean, in the case of Natalie Tennant, and yeah, I'm sorry, I was trying to be really nice in that thread that I was in, but it got a little frustrating on Facebook. In the case of Natalie Tennant, we're supposed to go and vote for her because she's not Shelley Moore Capito, and, well, nobody can dare speak a word against coal. I'm not asking the woman, and I want to be clear about this, I'm not asking the woman to go out and holler that coal is the devil, okay? I'm not. What frustrates me is the fact that you cannot get these candidates even to acknowledge that there is a problem. And anybody who's familiar with a 12-step program knows that the beginning of treating the problem is admitting that there is one. And it seems to me that West Virginia is in this place where we have to say, I admitted that I was powerless over coal and my life had become unmanageable. And they can't do that. So that means the problem's going to persist, doesn't it? Does any of this make sense?
Sure. And the metaphor for that, Bob, is 90% of those polled in America, all over America, wanted background checks on guns. 90% of the Americans wanted it, but not one politician, for fear of the NRA, would touch that issue with a 10-foot pole. And the reason, of course, is that they were fearful that the NRA would attack them and would defeat them. And so it's the same here in West Virginia. Although people, I think, people I talk to and people you talk to, you know, state to you and to me, yes, we ought to look at this issue logically. We ought to look at the question of carbon dioxide being spewed into the atmosphere, the question of global warming and climate change. These are all scientific facts, and we ought to not dismiss them or deny them. You know, these, I'm sure that Tennant and Capito both know the science, and they both, because they're not dumb people, they must recognize that the world is changing, and that if we don't do something about the mountaintop removal, and if we don't do something about spewing the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, that we're going to doom ourselves. They know this, but they're afraid of the coal industry. Very powerful industry. You know that as well as I do.
Well, absolutely. And in a larger sense, then, let's put it this way. If we can't talk about increased cancer, heart disease, and birth defect rates in the mountaintop removal areas of southern West Virginia,
right,
has the orthodoxy of Coal's control over the political class in this state become such that we can't talk about black lung either?
I don't know, but black lung is on the uptick, as you well know, and all those things you talk about the cancer rates on the increase in those areas around mountaintop removal and coal. I write about those things, by the way, in my book, Black Gold, Black Death, and I hope folks will read about it. But and I've got the statistics in there, and it's just incredible. If we can't talk about that, though, if we can't acknowledge these things, if we are blind to it, if we continue to simply deny it while birth defects occur, awful birth defects, while selenium pours into the streams from mountaintop removal and deforms the fish and deforms our human bodies, if we can't talk about these things, you know, here's the other part of it, Bob. 300,000 of my neighbors, my friends, their tap water was poisoned in the Kanawha Valley in 9 counties by a coal-related industry that leaked, you know, that chemical that they used to wash coal. 300,000 of my neighbors poisoned by this stuff, and yet, where's the outrage? Why are they so submissive? Why are people so meek? Why do they not? If this happened anywhere else, why, you'd never hear the end of it. So what's going on here?
I don't know. Some people have looked at us and said that West Virginia has the worst case of Stockholm syndrome they've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
During the midst of that crisis, which began on January the 9th, I kept saying, why aren't there? I mean, we're talking about your children. We're
right.
Talking about your children with a cancer diagnosis in 20 years.
Exactly.
Why aren't there? Okay, 300,000 people's water got poisoned. Why couldn't 1% of those people form a human chain around the capital of the
exactly.
of the state of West Virginia?
Exactly.
I mean, I'm a calm, reasonable, you know, relax, have a beer kind of guy.
Right.
But there comes a time when if you do not act, you will be acted upon. And this was that. And we got some people to, you know, a few people stood out in the cold in a candlelight vigil, and bravo to them for doing it.
Yes.
I do not take away from it. I do not demean that. But it wasn't enough.
No, it's too passive. You know, it really is, honestly. And I agree with you. I admire them for doing that. But believe me, horrible times, bad times require really drastic action from time to time.
I mean, I kind of, of course, I don't expect people to be as radical as I am. Because I've gotten downright uppity about the fact that 4,000 excess deaths occur in mountaintop removal communities every year.
Right.
I'm infuriated. But I saw, you know, I saw the whole Freedom Industries disaster as a massive failure, not of Freedom Industries alone, but of West Virginia American Water, which is a privately or which is a publicly traded corporation who uses our water bills to service their stockholders before they ever service their failing infrastructure.
Exactly.
And it was a failure of our government, because the question and the question that I asked Ed that got a little bit of life in it was, why was the system not shut off? Because if a terrorist had said we've poisoned West Virginia's water, the first thing the governor would have said would have been, shut the system down before any further harm can be done.
And not only that, but where are the arrests, Bob? How come nobody is held accountable in this? I thought people, you know, an Italian ship captain, if he runs aground with his ship, they arrest him immediately because of the dereliction of duty. Where's the legal action on this as well?
Well, exactly, and it's I thought you were going to go somewhere else. You know, shortly after the Freedom disaster, 20 Italian politicians, corporate people, were arrested because they had poisoned one town's water supply.
Right.
Inadvertently,
exactly.
Negligently, but yeah. There are laws against that. You know, we have a West Virginia code citation. Granted, it's a misdemeanor, but it's called stream littering. And for instance, if you happen to be toddling down the highway, and you squeeze your you drain your pop bottle, and you at this point in time we're assuming the person in question is a real asshat, flings his empty pop bottle out the window, and it lands in some little creek by the side of the road, and a state trooper sees it, he will pull you over. And he will cite you for stream littering. But 10,000 gallons of deadly poison? And nobody goes to jail? But a guy who takes a quart mason jar of blasting dust and sets it on the front stoop of the governor's mansion gets hauled off to South Central on Thanksgiving night?
It is
completely upside down here, and I don't mean to sound like a real screaming Mimi, Ed. That's not my purpose here. But the gravity of and the depth of the problems we face here are stunning. And so I guess the question is, you know, you're running for Congress, and you know there are congressional districts in New York City that are measured in city blocks, not miles.
Right.
You're running for Congress in a congressional district that is thousands of square miles.
Yeah, it's 300 miles from the Ohio River to the Potomac, 17 counties, 600,000 population, about 400,000 of those the 600,000 are registered voters. And so we're looking at probably in an off-year election about 180,000 of those folks will vote. In a three-way race, I need to get about 60,000 votes, and I hope the folks out there who listen to me and who are kind enough to do that and patient enough to do it will listen to the reality of what we're facing here in the 2nd Congressional District and in West Virginia and vote for a change. You know, that's the thing that really is important for them to recognize that there is a problem, as you have pointed out so vividly today and in your writings, And that will bring about a change. You know, if we go on the way we are, if we continue down this path, if we remain idle in the face of the horror that we find because of mountaintop removal and because of the polluting of our streams and poisoning of our water, if we continue to do that, then what does that say about us, and how will the nation look upon us, and if we don't diversify our economy and look to new and vibrant industries and educating our people and retraining our folks, we're in trouble. We're in serious trouble.
Well, the state is largely being depopulated. I guess a lot of people are anticipating that in the next census, which will be 2020, that we'll lose another congressional seat. We'll be down to two.
Wow.
At which point we're approaching Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota status.
Right.
And that the depopulation of West Virginia in itself is a topic for an entire evening's discussion.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've lost 40% of our population since 1950. That means that we're down from 2.5 to 1.8 million people. The best and the brightest are leading. They're voting with their feet. You know, people say, well, why don't you people in West Virginia get it? Well, I'll tell you, a lot of people do get it, and they leave. And that's the way they express themselves. They don't rain the Capitol with protesters. They just simply pack up their bags and go for opportunity elsewhere. Well, we have to staunch this. We're hemorrhaging people.
It's not just ordinary.
It
is a brain drain, Ed.
You got it. That's right.
And I don't mean to sound elitist or suggest that the people who aren't here aren't smart, because I know we
are.
Mm-hmm. But it increasingly leaves us vulnerable to the creation of an economy in which no one is dares expect more than $7.25 an hour. And you cannot run a state on those jobs, Ed.
No.
Let me ask you this. You know, we talk about problems inside West Virginia, but you're talking about running for the House. You're running for the House of Representatives, which is, of course, an office of national scope. So it is not just a matter of West Virginia's relationship with itself, but West Virginia's relationship with the nation and the nation's relationship with West Virginia. Upon arriving in Washington, D.C., how do you do you have any kind of a laundry list of stuff that you want to get after right away?
Well, the first thing I want to do is, as I said before, is try to get a moratorium on further mountaintop removal and this fracking business. I mean, those are issues that really require immediate attention here in West Virginia. And I think that I would be derelict if people voted for me and I were elected if I didn't respond immediately to that which they're telling me here in West Virginia that they need and want. And if, you know, I go up here in the farm country in the Eastern Panhandle, and the fracking industry there, people aren't getting jobs as were promised. People come in from out of state to work. Very few new jobs are provided. The noise pollution is incredible. The methane leaking into the atmosphere is far more dangerous than the carbon dioxide, and the polluting of the underground water system up there. People really are fearful and scared. So they asked me, Ed, if you go there to Washington, do something about that. So that, and coupled with the things you're talking about, Bob, about the problem with mountaintop removal here, those are things that I think demand immediate attention. There are things beyond that, obviously, that we can talk about, and it would require another radio program. But those are the things that immediately would talk about.
I hope we can have that further conversation, and you are welcome back here any time, and we are hopefully we're far from done yet. Let me just ask you specifically, because you know I'm very closely involved with the effort. Since we last talked, have you gotten a chance to learn a little bit more about the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act?
Well, I need to know more about it. I'll be honest with you. I just don't know enough about it.
Well, that's the moratorium bill that you're talking about.
Yeah.
As far as mountaintop removal is concerned.
Exactly.
And I'll be happy to be of any help that I possibly can in that regard. But you're also, one of the things, and this is, I guess there's a bit of a setup involved here. A few weeks back, I was in Washington, D.C., working on the AIC Act, and they had a big rally for climate change that was attended by 40 various members of both the House and the Senate. And it's very odd to see that many members of the House and Senate together in one place that isn't actually the governing body, you know, outside the hallowed halls, as it were. And they were all there to talk about the need for us to get real in this country about climate change. And what I heard in that rally was a lot of, you know, there were members of Congress from California, from Oregon, from Washington, from Massachusetts, from New York, all of whom, from Hawaii, all of whom talked about the very real-world consequences of climate change that they themselves have seen in their states. Now, being a hillbilly, I walk around with a chip on my shoulder, Ed. It comes with birth. It's attached. It's like a graft. And I sat there listening, and I never once heard climate change mentioned in the context of Appalachia. And I was reminded that once again that we are the forgotten part of this country. And I would ask you, I suppose, well, we weren't mentioned because there was no one there to mention it. Nick Rahal wasn't there. McKinley wasn't there. Arch's daughter wasn't there. Joe Manchin wasn't there. God, no. And I understand Senator Rockefeller just doesn't go a lot of anywhere these days. He's not that well a man. So there was no one to speak up for West Virginia, but there was a West Virginian there to be aggrieved by that fact. Will you become a, upon arrival in Congress, will you become a vocal advocate for dealing with climate change in Appalachia?
Well, I certainly intend to do that. And I, you know, what you just said about this being a forgotten part of America really resonates all over our state and with me. You know, I go out and one time I interviewed former President Harry Truman at the Kanawha Airport, and he had he'd been here making a speech, and so I said, how did he find being here? And he says, oh, well, it's always wonderful to be here in Virginia. And I said, well, Mr. President, you're in West Virginia. And he says, shot back at me, he said, well, it should have been Virginia. And, you know, you talk to people outside the state. Yeah, and you talk to people outside the state, and they say, where are you from? I'm from West Virginia. Oh, I have a cousin who lives in Richmond. And so that's hurtful, obviously. But
my neighbor's cousin always lived in Roanoke.
That's right. So, yes, the short answer to your question is absolutely. And, you know, I'm a big booster because I love West Virginia. I love the mountains. I love the people. And I'm not denigrating anyone when I talk about the need for us to stand up for ourselves. But we have an inferiority complex here in West Virginia, just as you suggested, and we need to get over that because we're much better than that.
Well, we certainly do. And you mentioned interviewing former President Truman. You have seen, by virtue of the long and distinguished career that you had in broadcast journalism, back when broadcast journalism was a reputable profession and not completely ruined by Fox News.
Right.
I believe you won Emmys.
Yes,
did
sir.
You not?
I'm proud to say I am the recipient of two Emmy Awards. I was nominated for three others. I also won the very coveted George Polk Award for a documentary I did in Guatemala about the killing off of the indigenous population down there, and covered the war in Vietnam, covered both of the Middle East wars. So I've seen my fair share of action, and I'm proud of that. I'm honored and gratified that I had that opportunity.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned those things because that's precisely where I was going, Ed. You have seen corners of the world where it's gotten about as bad as it can possibly get. When you compare that to, say, McDowell County, West Virginia, how does McDowell County fare against a Guatemala or a Gaza?
Here's the thing. As you point out, back when the old Soviet Union existed and they were and the Kremlin was trying to project power into the Western Hemisphere, they did that through Cuba into Central America, where there were guerrilla wars going on, and the arms and ammunition were supplied by the Soviets through Cuba. So I got to know those wars very well. I covered them. I covered the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua. I covered the Salvadoran communist uprising, guerrilla uprising, and I so therefore became very familiar with those Central American countries. And the poverty there was absolutely just awful. You know, it was something to abhor. And so the safety nets that we have here that are being decimated by the GOP, by the Republicans, in our country and in our state. You know, they want to take away the food stamps. They want to take away your Social Security. They want to take away those things which are sustaining us here, especially down in McDowell County, not because the people there are moochers or takers, but because they are the residue of what has happened to us and the coal industry. And consequently, if we allow these things to happen, then I think that we are going to wind up no better than the awful plight of those who are even to this day suffering in Central America. And that's one of the reasons we have this immigration crisis on our border with Texas, is because people are fleeing that kind of poverty. And I pointed out today in a Facebook comment that you talk about migration. As we said before, 40% of our own population has left the state because of this very problem that we're talking about. So I just, you know, if we don't staunch this, if we don't turn this the place around, if we can't find new ways of earning a living, if we can't diversify the economy, if we can't stop putting all our eggs in one basket, the coal industry, if we can't start, you know, wouldn't it be ironic if we were able to put in wind farms and solar panels on these mountains that we've chopped off the tops of? Wouldn't it be something to show the nation that we could provide jobs for miners in these new industries, these clean industries? Wouldn't that be something? Now, I know a lot of people are saying, well, that's pie in the sky. Well, it isn't. I think we have a very good chance to do that. But, yes, McDowell County these days is suddenly becoming, you can equate it with many of those deplorable countries in Central and South America.
Well, Ed, I tell you what, I get the sneaking suspicion. Well, one, let me just clearly say that I make no bones about the fact I don't believe in I don't believe in the phony objectivity that attends a lot of so-called journalism these days. I'm an advocate. I'm an advocate with a microphone, and I want people to vote for you. I want you to be their congressman. I wish to goodness you could be mine. And having said that, I'll suggest that Washington, D.C. may be a very, very interesting place to be here in the next few within the next few years. I'm sure you've seen the news as it's been breaking all day long. Here we are, you know, Barbara Tuchman's famous book was called The Guns of August.
Right.
And here we are a little more, just days more than exactly 100 years from what she wrote about.
Right.
A conflagration that gripped the world and slaughter the likes of which the world had never seen began a little over 100 years ago.
Right.
And it all began over something that was seemingly nothing. And I'm beginning to get a little creeped out, Ed. Today we find out that a civilian airliner with an entirely civilian crew and passenger manifest was shot down in the eastern Ukraine, not by Ukrainians. And at the same time we find that Israel has launched its ground invasion of Gaza. We have the aforementioned immigration crisis, which is largely the doing of American foreign policy that arises out of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador.
Right.
We have the very real problems of climate change that are affecting the entire planet.
Right.
We have an Ebola outbreak in West Africa that is growing and not receding. I could go on. How does a statesman approach all of these things? Because you know inevitably there will be and already have been the inevitable calls for war. I think John McCain has already called for us to pay the Russians back for that Malaysian jetliner. How does a person in such a position deal with that kind of thing?
Well, for one thing, Bob, I humbly say that I have some experience in that arena in the Middle East. I was based in Tel Aviv for 2.5 years and covered the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for nearly 3 years, and became very, very familiar with it. And I think I understand the problems that afflict that part of the world. I also covered both Gulf Wars. I was in Baghdad, and that means I was also in Damascus and Amman, Jordan, and I was in Tehran, Iran, during the air war, the first Gulf War. I was in Baghdad during the second Gulf War. And so I've had some experience in this arena, and I had some ideas about the way we ought to approach foreign policy. And I was at the Pentagon for 4 years as the national security correspondent for NBC News. And so I got to know our military very well, and also folks at the White House and in the Congress and at the CIA and the NSA and our intelligence agency. So I know these folks, and I'm familiar with the process. And I think that I can, I can help solve the problem. So I'd just like to have the chance.
I certainly think you deserve it. Because neither of your opponents can even begin to touch the level of world stage experience that you have. When we talk about your opponents, and I despise what was described in the 1990s as the politics of personal destruction. I do. But what does either Nick Casey or Mooney, and that's not a pejorative, by the way, that's really his name. What do they have to offer?
Well, I will let them speak for themselves, and I'll let their records speak for themselves. But you have to remember that Nick Casey has taken money from the fracking industry. He also was a lobbyist for the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce. And so when he and Mooney talk about the coal industry, for example, they're not talking about the miners and their families and their communities. What they're talking about is protecting the coal industry. What they're talking about is protecting the coal barons who steal our patrimony, who remove it from our state along with the profits. You know, the coal industry costs West Virginia about $100 million annually more than it pays in taxes. And a lot of people talk about, well, you know, the coal industry pays a lot of taxes into our state. Well, they do, but they also cost the state about $100 million because they tear up the roads and costs to monitor them, to supervise them, and also we grant subsidies and grants to the coal industry. So that's if that's what Mr. Casey has to offer, then I say that we need to take another look. As far as I know, I'm wondering about how it is that we in West Virginia cannot, I'm a native of West Virginia. I was born and reared in Charleston on the west side. I grew up close to Rabel Mountain, where my paternal grandfather was born and my great uncles were born. They're all farmers, good, decent, honest working people. So I have deep roots going here in West Virginia. But Alex Mooney is from Maryland. Alex Mooney's a carpetbagger. What does he have to offer West Virginia? Why should West Virginians vote for him? I mean, how is it that we can't find within our own state the kind of leadership that is required to represent West Virginians? I mean, why should we allow a Marylander, somebody who really was, apparently, according to the reports, the news reports, not a good representative of his own political situation over there? Why should we allow him to come here, and why should we vote for him? I don't understand it. And yet he is way up in the polls over Nick Casey. I don't understand it. So I don't think they have much to offer.
And I think I'm guessing that there's a little bit of frustration working with that, because what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, that sense of resignation that attends politics in West Virginia,
Right.
Obviously, you don't have the war chest that either Mooney with, and he's getting tons of Koch brothers money, by the way,
exactly.
Isn't he?
Yes.
You don't have a war chest that either Mooney or Casey have.
Correct.
How do you mount a campaign against that money without money to mount it with?
Well, it's a challenge. I take money only from individuals. I don't take it from any corporations. I don't take it from, as they do, from PACs or anything like that. I don't have personal wealth like Nick Casey has. And so I just depend on ordinary folks who have been kind enough, many of them, to send me $10 or $5 or $20 by way of my internet site, rabelforcongress.com, and they have an opportunity to push the donate button, and they can donate whatever they want. And some have, many have been kind enough to me to submit some money. But we don't have, we have very, very little money. So the only thing we can do is what I'm doing right now is talking with you and just talking directly to people. I intend to mount a grassroots campaign, which I go out and knock on the doors of people and talk to them individually, as I have been in garnering the signatures that were required to get me on the ballot in November. And just let them meet me, and they can make their own decisions. They can make their own choices, obviously, but I'm really appreciative that they gave me the chance to at least get on the ballot. I think people, you know, two-thirds of the people in a Gallup poll in America who were surveyed wanted a third choice or an independent to choose from. I hope that's true here in West Virginia.
I do, too. Art, let me ask you this. Are you... have there been any discussions? Are you going to be included in any public debates regarding?
I don't know. I tell you this in the past. You know, first of all, the first issue here is that the establishment more or less has ignored me, and I don't mean for that to sound petty. I just mean it's a fact of life. The other two candidates, their campaigns are covered by the major media. Mine hasn't been. I hope now that I'm on about that. The Secretary of State has certified me that they will pay more attention. But in the past, independent candidates like Jesse Johnson, for example, of the Mountain Party, they excluded him from televised debates. And they did it because they said his appearance would be a publicity stunt. Well, our campaign is not a publicity stunt. And I intend to challenge anybody who tries to keep me out of a debate because I think that people want to hear what I have to say, and I would love to be able to have the opportunity to say it to them. But we know who owns the television outlets and the radio outlets here in our state, and we know what the party that they are connected to, and we know why it's in their interest to try to keep me out of the public limelight because it doesn't serve them well to hear from me. So. It's going to be a challenge. I mean, there's, you know, make no bones about it. I mean, I understand. I'm not naive. I recognize what we're up against. But I'll do my best to try to get heard by the people.
It sounds like you're going to fall back on good old-fashioned door-knocking, hand-clasping retail politics. That's about where you are, isn't it?
That's the best we can do right now, and but I think that works, and I think and people have been willing to listen.
What kind of opportunity? I'm guessing I'm just pulling things out of a hat. I'm guessing sometime in October you may be trying to walk in the Black Walnut Festival parade in Spencer.
We'll do everything we can. We'll go to as many. Public events as invite us and want us to be a part of, and we'll go all over the state. I intend to work at this very, very hard. I don't intend to stint on my time and effort and so on. I've really committed fully to trying to meet as many people as I can and to personally ask them for their vote.
This is, of course, to my mind, what classic American politics is actually supposed to feel like. With that in mind, do you see yourself? Is this, and it's probably maybe it's premature to ask this. Is this the one time Ed Rabel's going to try this?
Well, I think I have an obligation, not only to the people of West Virginia, but also to myself. You know, I have tried over the years, not to sound sanctimonious or fatuous, but I've tried over the years my best to tell the truth as a reporter and to bring the truth to people in the world and in our nation and here in West Virginia. And many people I meet these days say, yeah, I remember you on the air, and we liked your reporting, and we think you're a straight shooter. And so I think that I have within my soul and within my spirit the obligation, the necessity, if you will, to serve if I can. And so I don't intend to stop. I intend to go on, and I intend to try to make myself heard and to get my message out there if I possibly can. And then in our great democracy, the people make the final decision. And they can listen if they will, and they can make a judgment about whether I make sense and whether I have something to offer and whether they believe in me or whether they want to go with the same old, same old. If they want to do that, well, that's their judgment. You know, that's what they will have to live with. But in the final analysis, I believe that, you know, times are changing, that a new era is at hand, that a new greatness for West Virginia can be had, but people have got to learn that they can't continue to depend on the coal industry, and they can't continue to depend on the fracking industry, and they can't continue to depend on these extractive industries and become sick and not to consign their children to poverty and to illness and to death. And so I just want to try to shed the light. You know, I'm not here to criticize my opponents, quite frankly. I'm here to light a candle, to try to show, to bring light to darkness. That's what I'm all about. And I hope that the folks will listen.
I do too, Ed. I sincerely do. And to the extent that I have some little bit of what I think is knowledge about the about, say, the folks who call themselves environmentalists. And also the folks who call themselves progressives in this state, Ed. For a very long time, we have felt like we just didn't politically matter because we never had anybody on the ballot that even remotely shared our concerns, our issues, our goals, our dreams. You're manifesting a lot of that, Ed. And I'm hoping you can reach out to those people because, just to use another race as an example, the Tennant Moore Capito race is a race between two people who can't figure out a way to say I love you to the coal industry quite enough.
Right.
And so that leaves a whole bunch of us out in the cold. And of course, I took some grief earlier for saying, those issues are so far divergent from mine that I don't see myself voting for either candidate. How can a candidate afford, especially, you know, like a Natalie Tennant, who is already badly down in the polls, how can she afford to say, oh, I don't want those progressive people. I don't need those environmentalists. I'll just love me some more coal. Who tells people, who tells a politician that they can win that way?
Well, I think she's getting some bad advice.
I think you're right. And I've obviously been thinking about this quite a bit. It seems to me, I'm guessing, her campaign is not being run by, you know, maybe her sorority sister at WVU, and I'm not trying to be sexist in that, you know, or maybe it's not being run by her best buddy from Phi Delta Theta either. It's being run by some Washington outsider who has come in loaded down to the wagon wheel hubs with conventional wisdom.
Right.
And it seems to me if there is ever going to be a turnaround in this state, I have a feeling that your campaign is the barometer for it, Ed.
Well, I hope so. I hope you're right.
You know, there's a lot of progressive people There's a lot of progressive people in your district. If you can convince them that you're the guy, this whole political thing may turn around, and it'll you'll be the pivot point on which it turns. Do me one other favor before you go, and I thank you so much for all the time you have given, Ed. How can people get a copy of your book?
Well, it's available on Amazon.com for one thing. And the title of the book again is Black Gold, Black Death, and the subtitle is In Coal Country, America's President is Marked for Assassination. So they can go to Amazon.com. I'm also doing a book signing at Taylor Books in Charleston, West Virginia, on Saturday the 26th, and I'll be doing book signings in various bookstores and locations throughout the district as the campaign gets going in here in July and August and September and October. So there'll be those opportunities as well. And of course, the book is going to be on bookshelves in the Charleston and up there in the Eastern Panhandle as well. So when I do book signings, well, usually the bookstores will stock the book. So that's one way that those are several ways that they can do it. I hope to see folks at the Taylor Books, by the way, on the 26th at 12 noon in Charleston.
I'm looking at my calendar right now. 26th. By Jove, that's a Saturday, Ed.
Right.
I might just be able to wander down the mountain and finally meet you in person for a change.
Well, I'd love that. I'd love to see you, Bob.
I would love that as well. I hope, and of course, this audience, the Horn Family Commune Congregation, as we laughingly call ourselves, is international in nature. So there, folks who want to read your book who aren't in West Virginia, their best bet is to go to Amazon for Black Gold, Black Death. And I hope you'll sell a good number of books. I'm looking forward to reading it myself.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Bob. I appreciate you having me on today.
Well, you are welcome here anytime, Ed. And I welcome your thoughts. You are obviously a man very much you're not by any stretch of the imagination a one-trick pony in West Virginia politics. You're clearly versed in everything that we would need a member of Congress to go to Washington and be able to do. So I wish you the best of luck. And one more time, please, Ed, your website where folks can go and contribute or try to find some way to be of help.
Yeah, it's Rabel for Congress, R-A-B-E-L for Congress, .com. And you can, what we stand for and what we're saying and the platform, everything's there. And you could also, if they feel like they wish to, we'd love for them to donate if they can, no matter what how much they have to donate.
Hear, 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 hear. Ed Rabel, thank you very much. You have yourself a wonderful evening, and the archive, if you want to let folks hear you talking on the Magic Radio Box, the archive will be available at whiterosesociety.org probably around 10:30 this evening.
Great. I'll tune in and listen.
Thank you, Ed, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Take care, Bob.
Bye now. Bye. Independent candidate for West Virginia's 2nd Congressional District, that is Ed Rabel. And I'm not in the West Virginia 2nd Congressional District at this particular moment in time. I wish to goodness I was, because Ed gives me a reason to be excited to go to the polls. And that, in a state like West Virginia, is a rarity. What you heard, I mean, he's an independent candidate, right? And we are very much a progressive-oriented radio network, and more than that, community. And tell me if I'm wrong, but didn't Ed sound a lot like a classic FDR-style Democrat? Or perhaps in a more modern context, didn't Ed sound a lot like another independent for whom we bear a great deal of respect in this community? Didn't Ed remind you a little bit of, say, Bernie Sanders minus the New England twang? We got a different twang down here, because he does me. And And there is no getting around the fact that he has an uphill climb. But I tell you what, some of the all the best climbs are uphill. The downhill climb is an anticlimax. It's climbing that mountain that makes you feel like you're doing something. And it's at the top of the mountain that you get your reward. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did, and we will be talking, I hope, again and again with Ed Rabel in the future as this campaign develops. It's important that Ed have a place to talk about his issues because this state does exist in a media lockdown. And there's no debating that. The for-profit media here are in, they're in the bag. They just are. I mean, it's a fact. So hopefully Ed will be able to go out and shake hands and walk in parades and introduce himself to people and hand them flyers and do politics the old-fashioned way, and maybe working politics the old-fashioned way, find his way to Washington, D.C. It is about a minute past the hour. See what happens with great conversation? The time flies. It's about a minute past the hour on this Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn, the 17th day of July, 2014. And we do. We've got a lot of creepy, creepy stuff to talk about. And not that I'm trying to bring anybody down, but at least if we're talking about it together, we're not terrified. We're not sitting out there all alone and terrified one by one by one. And just trying to understand just the things that happened today will be enough to keep us busy. So we'll take a little break. It being Thursday, that means we have the Green News Report from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And that will be coming up presently. Remember, we're trying to raise $85 this evening. Thanks very much to folks like Thomas and Sal and Jane and Jerry. They took our fundraising. We took a little bite out of it last night. We can take a bigger bite. We can finish it off this evening. Thus far, no takers. But $85 to go to come up with this evening's fundraising goal. And anybody who wants to help can go to the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com and help out. This is Conversation Radio of the listener-supported variety. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, this is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Now Buffalo Creek's swelling, broken all its water, come the horn down. Sweeping away the home lives of West Virginia town. And in that cold and rainy flood, more than 100 people drowned. Some say the flood was caused by rain, some said melting snow. Deep down in my heart, I believe the coal mine bosses know. They strip off all the topsoil and they uproot all those trees. And they kill the folks in Buffalo Creek and they'll shrug the blame with ease. They don't give a damn for life or the land, they roll on like they please. Some say the flood was caused by rain, some said there was snow. Deep down in my heart I believe the coal mine bosses know. Governor said the flood was just an act of God's own will. Strippers tear these mountains down, it's enough to make me ill. The hooray for Appalachia, for the greenback dollar bill. Some say the flood was caused by rain, some said melted snow. Deep down in my heart I believe coal mine bosses know. Buffalo Creek, Buffalo Creek, it's a coal mine bosses show. Buffalo Creek, Buffalo Creek, how could they sink so low? Strip mine bosses trade our lives for nickels and for dimes. Well, I beg you folks to stop these men. Don't you let this happen twice. You can see those people drowning there. Don't you hear their mournful cry? I hear them through the falling rain. Nail on me in the snow. Buffalo Creek, Buffalo Creek, it's a coal mine boss show. Buffalo Creek, Buffalo Creek, when will you people know? And when will you folks tell these boys to pack their gear and go?
It's Thursday, July 17, 2014.
To date, Tony Abbott has made Australia the first country in the world to reverse action on climate change.
Australia's right-wing government repeals landmark carbon tax.
Climate change is a threat to public safety. It's a threat to public health.
While Obama moves forward on bracing for global warming impacts. Record wildfire season burning from California to Alaska. Plus,
I see broken sprinklers all the time, water gushing down the street, and that seems really immoral to me.
California gets tough on water wasters.
All of those wasters and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
So climate change poses a direct threat to the infrastructure of America.
Just another distraction from Benghazi. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a lot going on today. Wildfires all across the West, but some very, very big news from down under.
Yes, indeed. Some very controversial news from Australia's Conservative Prime Minister, Tony Abbott.
He was the person who said that under a carbon price, a leg of lamb would cost $100. He's lied about climate change, and today he has taken Australia backwards.
The right-wing administration of Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who is a prominent climate science denier, has finally succeeded in repealing Australia's landmark carbon tax on the nation's biggest polluting industries. It's a huge flip-flop from Abbott, who advocated for a carbon tax back when he was out of power in 2011.
If you want to put a price on carbon, why not just do it with a simple tax?
The repeal this week was condemned by environmental groups and Australia's opposition leader, Bill Shorten.
History will judge Tony Abbott very harshly for refusing to believe in genuine action on climate change. Tony Abbott is sleepwalking Australia to an environmental and economic disaster. Tony Abbott has demonstrated time and time again that he is an environmental vandal with no view of the future.
Australia has the highest emissions per person in the world. That's due to its heavy reliance on coal. But the carbon tax on the largest polluters was successful. In just 2 years, it reduced Australia's electricity sector emissions alone by 5%. And millions in tax rebates were going to be returned to Australian households.
This is amazing to see. It comes after two of the hottest summers in Australian history.
Yep.
And for Tony Abbott to turn back the clock like this, why?
It's a gift to the biggest polluters, the biggest industries in Australia, which are, of course, the biggest financiers of Tony Abbott's campaign.
Underscoring what this fight has always been about by those pretending climate change is not going on, this is about protecting the profits of the fossil fuel industry. Period. End of story.
Meanwhile, here in the U.S., President Obama bypassed Congress again this week.
Let's sue!
In announcing new help for cities to prepare and adapt to the impacts of global warming.
Climate change poses a direct threat to the infrastructure of America that we need to stay competitive in this 21st century economy. That means that we should see this as an opportunity to do what we should be doing anyway, and that's modernizing our infrastructure, modernizing our roads, modernizing our bridges, power grids, our transit systems, and making sure that they're more resilient. That's going to be good for commerce, and it's obviously going to be good for communities.
The suite of initiatives will provide technology assistance and additional funding for cities and towns to harden local infrastructure against the increasingly expensive impacts of global warming, like water supply security, flooding and storm surge controls, and recovery from disasters. Meanwhile, speaking of disasters, thousands have been evacuated as firefighters in Oregon and Washington fight high winds and extremely dry conditions to contain at least 17 large fires across both states. It's worse in Western Canada, where hot, dry weather is fueling one of the worst fire seasons on record. Radio Canada reports 31 new fires broke out across Canada in one 24-hour period this week alone. The Western drought is forcing California to get tough on water wasters. New rules passed by California's State Water Resources Board this week allow for fines of up to $500 per day for anyone caught overwatering outdoor landscaping or hosing down sidewalks with drinking water amid the state's worst drought on record. But that applies only to commercial and residential users. The state's agriculture industry uses three-quarters of the state's water but is exempt from the new measures. And in Nevada, Lake Mead, the reservoir behind the Hoover Dam that is the primary source of water for Las Vegas, has now reached a record low. Contrary to popular belief, the city of Las Vegas uses less than 10% of Lake Mead's water. The biggest user is, again, the agriculture industry.
Oh, you and your efficiency. We've got a planet to feed, lady. For much more on that and the stories we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Amazing story out of Australia. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Do you come from a land down under?
Oh, yeah. One of the catchiest tunes ever to come out of Australia, but I tell you what, I got something way cooler here. And maybe, you know, next break or something. The Di Pritchard Band. You want to hear some rock and roll out of Australia? I'll play you a little lick here in a little bit. The Di Pritchard Band, brand new album, Killin' Time. Or Killin' Time. You can say that multiple ways. I'll try to remember to run a track there just to, because it ain't all minute work. As peppy and upbeat as that tune was. This is The Horn, Thorn in the Side, Thursday, the 17th of July, 2014. I should note that the lines are open. Area code 304-574-8178. 304-574-8178. If you wish to, reach the program just Skype to Skype. That's real easy, too. The Skype contact is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn. And I would welcome your thoughts on the conversation just previous with Ed Rabel or the other stuff that's out in the news. And like I said to Ed, this is the 17th day of July. So that means there are 14 more days in the month before we hit August 2014, which more and more and more is looking like a most ominous anniversary. I tell you truly, I was out and about. I had to go over and talk with Dr. Bill a little bit earlier today. And I was out and about when I got an alert on my mobile device that an airliner, a civilian airliner, owned by poor Malaysia Airlines. I mean, talk it. Wow. They got to feel snake bit at Malaysia Airlines. Had been shot, well, had been, had crashed in the eastern Ukraine coal mining region of Donetsk, which is absolutely infested with pro-Russian separatists, terrorists. You use the vocabulary of your choosing. And as everyone sort of held their breath, wondering what the was going on, the Ukrainian government wasted little time in noting that the passenger airliner had been shot down, and they even gave the name of the missile system, Buk, B-U-K. President Obama then took to the, airwaves in one degree or another and said it looked like a tragic accident. And you know what? I don't fault him for that. Because the last thing you want to do is to run out behind the podium with your hands shaking in the air going, They shot it down. Because that's the sort of thing of which wars are made. Say whatever else you will, the man has a sense of calm and cool that could come in handy here fairly shortly. And, you know, at the risk of going all Alex Jones, I looked a little fish-eyed when CNN immediately began reporting that the United States has agreed and concluded that the plane was shot down, but has not pinpointed who was responsible, a senior U.S. official told CNN's Barbara Starr. But apparently there was radar tracking radar was turned on, the thing was tracked, the shot was fired, the plane went down. That's what's being reported. According to CNN, a radar system saw a surface-to-air missile system turn on and track an aircraft right before the plane went down, the senior U.S. official said. A second system saw a heat signature at the time the airliner was hit, the official said. The United States is analyzing the trajectory of the missile to try to learn where the attack came from. Call me crazy. The ground? Maybe. But maybe not. Because just a couple of days before, the Ukraine accused the Russians, and particularly a Russian fighter jet, of shooting down a Ukrainian aircraft. Jim, your prose is not prolix. I'd like to know, Jim just emailed and said, on tape is a recording by a missile officer that we effed up. Oh, no. But I need a little detail. Who, for instance, Jim, is we? Randy asking, do you think someone or some government has it in for Malaysian Airlines? It's the 21st century. Anything is possible until eliminated as a possibility. Oh, by the way, a note coming in from Jan and Jerry in Vegas. What a wonderful conversation with Ed Rabel. I wish he was someone I could vote for. And that's the problem. The really, really good ones are few, 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 and far, far, far between. But I am certainly creeped out by the Malaysian Ukraine thing. Apparently, before any of us found out about it, and it kind of should be this way, I guess, President Obama found out about it. For some reason or another, he just happened to be on the phone with big bad Vlad Putin. No word yet on whether Putin had his shirt on during the phone call, but I guess that's irrelevant. But toward the end of the phone call, according to the published reports that I saw, Putin said to him, "Oh, by the way, Mr. President, it appears that there has been plane crash in the eastern part of our province. I mean, independent nation of Ukraine. It was apparently big plane. We don't know how it happened, but we didn't do it, and we wasn't there. And even if we did, we was only following orders." Okay, so Jim clearing things up a little bit. He says apparently there is a statement on tape saying we effed up, and linguistics experts are analyzing the dialect of the statement to find out who it is that says they effed up. Al Jazeera, according to our friend Luta, Al Jazeera is reporting, and Al Jazeera actually does journalism, so this should probably get a little more weight than, say, anything coming out of Fox News TV, Radio Rwanda. Al Jazeera reporting pro-Russian fighters in the Donetsk area have seized the black box and are hanging on to it and will not surrender it. We've started worldwide conflagrations for less now, haven't we? I mean, I don't mean we, the United States, but, an archduke. And how many millions died for that? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, you live in interesting times, huh? Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak said the plane never made any sort of distress call that would indicate something catastrophic and fast. Vlad Putin took to the airwaves, and he said, "Tragedy would not have happened if there had been peace on that land, or in any case, if military operations in southeastern Ukraine had not been renewed. And without doubt, government of territory on which happened bears responsibility for this frightening tragedy." Oh, that's nice. Happened over your country, it's your fault. Granted, we've got a shitload more weapons than you do, but it's on you, buddy. There were witnesses. Noah Snyder is an American freelance journalist and was interviewing witnesses at the scene. He reported to CNN, people said the plane kind of exploded in the air and that everything rained down in bits and pieces. The debris field is apparently spread out over a matter of kilometers. Snyder continued and said, "As you walk through the fields, you see a man with his cracked iPhone sticking out of his pocket. You see sort of people's clothing everywhere. Most of it's kind of ripped off by the air. There's some suitcases and stuff in a pile by the road." So the accusations are flying. And, truth is probably already a casualty of this sorry event. The plane had left Schiphol, never know how to pronounce that, airport in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and was bound for Kuala Lumpur. And that's part of the, that's just apparently from what I've read, that is the typical route that is taken for such flights. And American investigators were offered to the Ukrainian government. The Ukrainian government immediately said, thank you, yes, we'll accept. And so they are en route to the scene. Jim reminding me via email of the Iranian passenger jet that the USS Vincennes shot down. 280 dead there. And of course, what was it? Japan Airlines and Korean Airlines and Marty pointing out, sadly, that will be the last major aircraft of any kind flying anywhere near the Ukraine. No. Well, depends on whether you consider Russian fighter jets major aircraft. But I get Marty's point. Sentient being in the chat room noting, I've got my stainless colander on. And of course, in all the who shot it down, what shot it down, can we take a moment and feel a certain degree of sympathy for the people who died? Yeah, that 295 people aboard that Boeing 777. Malaysians, Dutch, Australians, Germans, one Canadian. And the hot and heavy is beginning. Valentin Nalyavichenko said, now you know who carried out this crime. We will do everything for the Russian military who carried out this crime to be punished. Oh, good. Because, of course, Ukraine can punish the Russian military. But then again, there's always Bomber John McCain, who did not waste any time, raced out of his office or his home or wherever he was. Anybody, my friends, anybody here got a camera? You with the iPhone, turn the video on. Someone must be heavily punished for this heinous act, he said, waving his jiggly old arm in the air. John, go take your Aricept and sit down and shut up and let the grown-ups deal with this. Oof. But that's not all. Oh, no. If you go to the CNN website, they've got a segment there down the left sidebar that says The Latest. And I just scanned it earlier today, and I realized it seemed like some sort of absurdist, Dadaist poetry. Digital bomb left in NASDAQ, Broadway star Elaine Stritch dies. Blues guitarist Johnny Winter dead, school shooting, 9/11 calls released. Lab woes hindering CDC work. Microsoft cutting 18,000 jobs. Mom, two suspects killed in a bank robbery. Flesh-eating amoeba lurks in water. New life for boy tied to bus stop. Help for India's boy on a leash. Body cam shows dying toddler tornado causes lightning in store. Airbus files patent for saddle seats. Classic VW Beetle goes electric. ESPN anchor gives powerful speech. Bachman, Clinton should worry. McEnroe's son busted in drug deal. America's favorite athlete is... God damn, Allen Ginsberg couldn't have done any better than that. Well, thank you, Kelly. Kelly with a message. Great interview with Ed Rabel. I wish we could change things in this state. In this state, in this country, oh Lord, in this world. Seriously, has no one ever looked at John McCain and said, John, you're not helping some more? Lo and behold, over there, Andrea Mitchell got the scoop today. Senator John, Arizona Media Reporting, KTAR. Senator John McCain has reportedly promised incredible repercussions if it is proven a Malaysian passenger jet was shot down over Ukraine. The KTAR report cites Huffington Post, who in turn wrote, "To leap to conclusions could be very embarrassing and really inappropriate until we have more information," McCain told Andrea Mitchell. "But there have been, as you mentioned, previous incidents of shot down of Ukrainian aircraft. This was an airliner headed towards Russian airspace, and it has the earmarks, and I'm not concluding, but it has the earmarks of a mistaken identification of an aircraft that they may have believed was Ukrainian. If that's true, this is a horrible tragedy event, which was certainly unanticipated by anybody, no matter who they are, and there will be incredible repercussions if this is the case. Exactly what those will be will have to be determined by how we find out who was responsible, my friend. We are all Ukrainians now." Okay, I added the "my friend, we are all Ukrainians now" part. "If it is a result of either separatists or Russian actions mistakenly believing this was a Ukrainian warplane, I think there's going to be hell to pay, and there should be. Wave that bloody shirt, John, with that one good arm you got." Jesus. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Edward.
Yes. Well, I turned to this program today. It was advertised on my dish. It's called Newsmax TV.
Oh, dear God, Edward. Turn away. Turn away.
I did. The guy's name who was doing the interview was named Ed Berliner. I thought he was going to break into Deutschland über alles at any moment. And guess who he was interviewing? Dick Morris.
The toe-sucking guy?
Yeah. Maybe he was sucking the Ed Berliner's toes. I don't know.
Please, that's just one mental image too far. Edward, no, don't do that to me.
I'll try not to.
I haven't had my dinner yet. And now I won't.
Oh, well, I could tell you one little funny thing. We were talking legal stuff and everything. And I thought that was something that the head librarian at the Underwood Law Library at Southern Methodist told me. Her name was Herbernia Turberville. Now, that's a mouthful. And anyway, we called her Bernie for short. Anyway, she noticed that her proctor on torts was getting sort of dog-eared and everything, so she called the bindery, and they came and got them and to rebind them. And she got them back, all done in beautiful leather with gold lettering on it, the whole thing. And she told me, I got looking at them, and I thought, there's something wrong here. And then it dawned on her, these guys didn't know anything about the law. They had put this beautiful gold lettering on each volume, and it said Prosser on Trots.
Only somebody who's been through the first year of law school and owned his or her own copy of Prosser on Trots will understand that.
You know, I thought you might appreciate
absolutely.
That.
Prosser was always my favorite textbook in law school, because Prosser originally and the subsequent editors had gone to great lengths to tuck away some fun little cases in there that everybody knew within a month of starting law school. There was the case that was written in and it came out of England. There was a case that was actually written in verse, and it had to do, and since you were a law librarian, some of this stuff will make sense to you. It had to do with the tort of tortious interference with business relations. And it was a case about a labor leader in England who had gone about the business of trying to represent some abused circus performers. And the show promoter had sued him for trying to interfere with his business relations with the carnival. And in turn, the judge in the case wrote his opinion in verse, and it concerned a traveling entertainment called the What Tut Tut Review.
I bet that was entertaining.
And the judge, you know how a judge sets up a fact pattern in a case, right?
Mm-hmm.
In an opinion. Well, he explained that the labor leader, a man named Lug, had gotten involved because there were complaints that the young women, the dancing girls in the review, were so poorly paid that they were being forced into what the writing judge said was an older and more infamous trade. And he leads into his opinion, as I said, in verse, and obviously this has stuck with me all these years. The ladies of the chorus of the What Tut Tut Review, by economic necessity, were forced their virtues to eschew. And there were all kinds of little nuggets like that scattered throughout the book. So yes, I know my Prosser and.
Prosser on Trots.
Right, but well, that's the whole thing. On exam day, it was Prosser on Trots, because everybody had them.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite words is tortfeasor. That sounds like something you do if you're eating too many burritos.
Exactly. Yeah, with the really spicy green salsa.
Oh yeah. Well, take care. Have a good evening.
I will certainly try. Edward, you have a wonderful evening yourself.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Our buddy Edward calling from Dallas. Yeah, tortfeasor. You have your cup of coffee in law school, and you find yourself becoming comfortable with a lot of weird words. Oh, by the way, updates coming to the aircraft story via Luta. Following Al Jazeera, Luda notes that it is being reported. They said that this was the normal direct route from the Netherlands to Kuala Lumpur, but because of the ongoing war, most other airlines have been avoiding that airspace. But Malaysia Airlines decided to do the direct route anyway because the cost of going around wasn't worth the risk. It's apparently not illegal, but as one Al Jazeera correspondent put it, just downright stupid and immoral. Refuse to... Yeah, refused to adjust to the Williams shift for the old baseball fans out there. Tim from L.A., air murder at the subject line. Not to sound tinfoil hat, but would it surprise you that the U.S. intelligence either contracted this hit so we could blame our enemies and bomb the hell out of them worse, or worse, sold the SAM to whatever country or group not knowing they would use the weapons in this fashion? Nothing surprises me anymore. And I hate it, Tim, but nothing surprises me either. But if you apply the Sherlock Holmes approach, some of that just kind of has to go, barring further evidence. Oh, wonderful. A note from Juanita. Hooray, Juanita says, I finally got a speaker that works somewhat and heard you for the first time in a long time. Oh, Juanita, that's wonderful. So glad to hear Ed Rabel, Juanita says, at last. Has or have any of the politicians in your state bothered to ever see in person what mountaintop removal does to the citizens? Or do they care? Juanita says, I guess they're afraid. Oh, no, they fly over and they say things like this, and I promise this is almost a quote. Well, of course a mountaintop removal site looks ugly. All construction sites look ugly. That's all a mountaintop removal site is. It's a construction site. And when everything's done and they plant the grass, it's just so pretty. Yeah, they do that, Juanita. Juanita continues, the song about coal was amazing, the one you played after the interview with that had all the banjos in it. That was just called Buffalo Creek. She says, with all the national and world news, guess you've heard some about Central Florida, especially the Ku Klux Klan and our law enforcement. Surprise, surprise. Yeah, I read that story. I haven't gotten to it on air yet, but I read it. Can you imagine, Juanita asks, if McCain and Palin had won, where we would be now? Here a war, there a war, everywhere a war, war, war. Sarah would have folks like me burned at the stake. And she'd light the match, too, Juanita. Juanita says, I hope I can continue to hear you. You're sounding amazing. I felt like Ed Rabel sounded almost like an Englishman. We need a ton of folks like him to take over our politics. By the way, Juanita concludes, I've had my second call today wanting my opinion on our upcoming Democratic primary. Given a choice from 1 to 100, they wanted my opinion on Rick Scott. I gave him a zero. Only because they won't let you play with algebra on those things, Juanita. You couldn't give him, like, negative 869,212,304. Rick Scott. Unindicted co-conspirator. Irish Dave is in rare form this evening. Process trots? That's some shit, huh? And he observes, the Malaysians flew that route because money. Because that's the truth. Hey, we've got Devin with us on the phone. Hey, Devin.
Hey, Bob.
What's happening?
Oh, it's just one of those days.
Which
especially
one?
Especially considering what we were talking about in Skype last night. I hate being right.
What was that?
No, just talking about, the fascism is on the march and all of the issues with everybody is painted into a corner, whether it's nations or people.
Run away.
And what do you know? Wasn't what I had in mind for today, anyways. But
well, then again, most of your adult life was not what you were promised when you were, entering grade school. Now, was it?
No. But am I to understand that it's pretty well confirmed that this was the Russians and the rebels?
Well, I don't know that that's confirmed, but it's confirmed that it was a missile.
Yeah.
It wasn't Colonel Mustard in the billiard room with the lead pipe.
Well, the only launch platform that they have, and this is the Russians that have this launch platform, it's Soviet era, and from the best that I've been able to gather, the Ukrainians did not have. You know, they're like two things they gave up, the nukes and these things.
The nukes and the good Sams.
Yeah. The platform, the name of it in English is Oak, because they named all their anti-aircraft platforms after trees.
Well, in the immediate aftermath of the news of this event, Devin, one of the Ukrainian politicians ran out to the nearest microphone and said it was shot down, and it was a Buk, B-U-K, was the way it was reported in the for-profit media. Buk.
Yeah, so in English, that's Oak.
I'll be dipped. Wonder who would have one of those in that neighborhood.
Well, it starts with an R, and it's to the east of the Ukraine.
Yeah. I wonder if maybe they had a little fire sale, and somebody came wandering up from the old coal country of Donetsk and said, "Would like to buy your surface-to-air missile."
Well, apparently, somebody whose name starts with a P decided to send somebody driving through the countryside with it and across the border and all that. Because,
baked into a really, really big baklava or something?
Well, not really, because this thing, I mean, you know, you can't even drive it on the road because it's bigger than the road.
Wow, kind of hard to miss. You'd think that would be kind of hard to miss coming through your neighborhood.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing you have to drive through the fields because, you know, you just can't drive it on the road. Think a D9 Cat with a roof rack. And then on the roof rack, there's basically four V2 rockets on it.
Dang.
This thing, if you want to shoot
a U2 or a
Blackbird, this is what you use.
Yeah, it looks like a tank chassis with tracks and stuff. At least the one I'm looking at, and a brace of four missiles.
But it's a lot bigger than a tank.
Okay. I don't have anything to give scale. It just looks like a tank body.
Yeah. But those missiles are good for up to 75,000 feet.
You know, this might be a good teachable moment, Devin, so that folks can maybe understand the difference between missile, this, and rocket, Gaza.
Yes. This can go
this has a
to
guidance
the edge
system.
Of space.
Yeah, this thing has a guidance system on it. It can go where it's sent. It's not like the rocket goes up, who cares where it comes down, it's not our concern, says Werner von Braun. No, not that.
Yeah. Yeah, locks onto a target. I think it's radar, but I could be wrong about that. And it's an old system. You know, it probably has vacuum tubes in it because.
Well, one report I'm seeing says the Buk uses a radar acquisition system for targeting.
Yes. So say if they targeted a MiG and the MiG shut off their radar, and the you know, the Boeing's 777 is flying along with its radar on.
Yeah, the,
it can shift over to lock on the next source.
Yeah, one source noting the book. These aren't highly trained FAA air traffic controllers at the trigger of the book. You're tracking something on radar. You see a dot. You get confused. And this particular person, Larry Johnson, a former CIA person, said, "I think it was mistaken identity. You know, oopsie."
Yep.
So it wasn't intentional, I mean, except for the fact that they have one of these, and they were trying to shoot something down. It just happened to be a passenger airliner full of innocent civilians.
And they didn't have one of these a few days ago?
Oh, they didn't?
No. That's the impression that I get, is the Ukrainian military did not possess these.
Have you checked eBay? I mean, are they out there to be had? Because, you know, maybe the NRA wants maybe the NRA wants every American to have one too. Sorry, I'm being a little snarky.
Something tells me that you're not going to find that on eBay.
I'm guessing there are no police reports in Russia saying surface-to-air missile system stolen last Saturday night.
Oh, well, they'll probably have one.
They're working on one right now.
Pretty soon.
Yeah, they're dummying one up even as we speak.
Basically, what's been going on is the Ukrainian Air Force has been, hammering the rebels. And the rebels are losing, and so, you know.
And again, nothing is
Russia easy. Russia takes dramatic action.
And nothing is easy here, because let's do remember that there is an ugly fascist streak inside the Ukrainian government.
Well, there's an ugly fascist streak inside of the Russian government. There's an ugly fascist streak inside of the U.S. government.
Oops, you just had to go there, didn't you?
And, well, damn near every other government.
They're on the march again, and fascists do love them some marching.
Absolutely. And they love their fancy boots, and they love to do them stomping.
Maybe if we gave them free passes to Kinky Boots on Broadway. Nah, that'll never work. God, nah, I'm doing my best to try to take a little of the sting out of it, but God almighty. I mean, no, really. I see this, and of course this is overshadowing the fact that the Israelis have begun their ground war against the country that doesn't have any army, and that's kind of hard to ignore.
Yeah, I mean that's. Well, I remember the last the last big hoopla in Gaza where they decided to test out all kinds of new weapons on people.
Those really cool dime weapons?
Well, it was some sort of a thing that they would drop in there, and they exploded about knee high, and they called them some sort of a fusion device, not necessarily nuclear fusion, but fusing materials together and causing a shaped blast. They don't produce shrapnel.
Yeah, that's the dime weapon.
Okay.
And of course, in the last time they blazed into Gaza, they dropped white phosphorus munitions all over creation.
Yeah, at street level, big white phosphorus flares.
Yeah.
And they set them to go off at street level.
And what's really, really, you know, if that stuff hits you, it's a sign, it's a known scientific fact that you can't put it out. It's going to burn you until there's no more of you to burn. You know, whether you're a 3-year-old Palestinian or a 90-year-old Palestinian, you're going to keep on burning.
I think there's only like one or two things that you could put on that that actually stops it, and I guarantee you they don't have it.
No. No. God.
Yeah, the reports from last time from the international doctors that went in there to try to save some people. You know, if you want something disgusting, that's it. And those the dime weapons, I never, is it DIME?
Yes.
Or what? Okay.
Yeah, it's an acronym.
The way those things work, it basically separates all
dense,
flesh
inert,
from everything.
Dense, inert, metal, explosive.
Okay.
According to the Wikipedia entry, they consist of a carbon fiber casing filled with a mixture of explosive and very dense micro shrapnel, consisting of very small particles, 1 to 2 millimeters, or powder of a heavy metal. Today, tungsten alloy, composed of tungsten and other metals such as cobalt and nickel or iron, have been the preferred material for the dense micro shrapnel or powder. They are intended to limit the distance at which the explosion causes damage to supposedly avoid collateral damage in warfare. But here's the fun part. Because they're made of tungsten, they're cancer-causing too. So if you maybe just get like wounded by one and not killed, a few years later, you got cancer. Wow, chemical warfare as well as, oh, yeah.
Well, that's why they call it genocide.
Yippers.
Yeah, that is a really nasty, really nasty device. I mean, it literally separates, you know, flesh from bone. There won't be a mark anywhere on you. But just everything inside is destroyed. You know, it's just sort of a sack of, you know.
Yeah, a sack of former
bone,
human.
A sack of, you know, bony bits and sludge.
Eesh.
You look just fine on the outside. Not even break the skin.
Ugh.
Because they were shaped charges, you would have people whose you know, they had to basically amputate their legs below their hips.
God Almighty. Yeah, in the ongoing effort to engage in what is always referred to as self-defense. Oh, let's see, where are we? Yeah, there it is. Three little Gaza boys out playing, at a beach, were prevented from ever becoming terrorists. Because self-defense.
Yep.
Israel has called up.
Video of that.
Israel has already called up additional reservists. They've already called up 50,000 previously. They are sending infantry, artillery, armored corps, engineering corps, supported by what the New York Times calls Israel's vast intelligence capabilities, as well as aerial and naval bombardment. Yes, the Israeli Navy is off the coast of Gaza, shelling into Gaza itself, which we will, you know, people need to be reminded, is the single most densely packed piece of real estate on the planet.
Yeah, they tell them to leave, but there's nowhere to leave to.
Can't get into Israel. Can't get into Egypt. Swim. Let's see. According to the New York Times, day by day, in Gaza through July 17th, the Israelis have targeted 1,653 discrete targets and have killed 230 people. At least 80 of them or so civilians. In Israel, Hamas has fired 1,241 of their crappy little rockets and have managed to kill one person. This is what you would call disproportionate in the laws of war, but they don't apply. Stockton Larry in the chat room pointing out, you know, if them Palestinians would just go back where they came from,
that would be called an invasion.
No, that would be called going back to the apartment. I mean, I know me some ancient history. There was a city there called Ashkelon, which was important even during the days of the pharaohs. Same folks were living there then.
If they went back to where they came from, most of them came from what is now Israel.
Well, actually, some of them didn't necessarily, unless I've got things really bass-ackwards. You're familiar.
People have been herded.
No, herded
out of Israel.
We're gonna have to travel back to 1400 before the Common Era for this or thereabouts. And,
oh dear.
And the single greatest power in that part of the world was a magnificent civilization, Devin, called the Minoans. We call them the Minoans. We have no idea what they called themselves because we can't read their language. They came up with writing contemporaneously, or almost contemporaneously, with the other cultures that came up with writing over in the Fertile Crescent. You know, Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. But theirs was entirely different, and it was apparently a one-off. But they had a magnificent, beautiful civilization that absolutely controlled the entire Mediterranean, and they were traders. And we get the Theseus myth out of the ancient Minoan civilization, and probably several others. And they set up colonies, trading colonies, all over the Mediterranean world. And one of the colonies they set up was on the Levant, two or three of them. But long about 1400 BCE, an island that at the time was known as Thera and is now known as Santorini just blew up. One minute it's an island, and the next minute it's a crater. And it sent a tsunami and earthquakes that absolutely wrecked the culture at Crete. And so the Minoan colonies along the shore, and including the ones in the Levant, were kind of left to their own devices and evolved thusly. So that's, at least, unless I've got everything completely turned around, that's where that came from. Oh, by the way, I need to issue a correction that this all reminds me of. I mentioned something about scrubbing that tablet that the Statue of Liberty is holding clean and just writing "keep out" on it. I was wrong in what's on the tablet, because what's on the tablet is like July 4th, 1776. It's down at the base of the Statue of Liberty that the new Colossus by Emma Lazarus, with the "give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." That's where that's written. That's what needs to be unscrewed from the wall and just thrown into New York Harbor.
Well, may as well change the tablet while you're at it, too. I mean, what good's a keep out sign if it isn't, hundred and some foot in the air.
Well, it's great. No, I said, but it's like it says July 4th, 1776 on it. Yeah, we'll take the Dremel and just, you know, and get all of that off there and just change it to keep out. Signed, Teabaggers.
Well, either that,
yes, this means
really
you.
Big iPad.
Hey, Devin, good talking to you. I'm going to take a little break here, and we'll see what's going to. We'll see if we can't wander through the rest of the program.
All right.
All right. Have yourself a good evening.
Talk to you later.
Good talking to you, Devin. Bye now.
All right.
Our buddy Devin calling from up in the radio quiet zone of Almost Level West by God, Virginia. Thanks, Sparky. Yeah, there's another article. Missile launcher in the Malaysian Airlines flight developed during the reign of the Soviet Union. Wasn't one of ours. So let's do take a break. I'll tell you, I for no other reason than I got to hear this song. Because, you know, there was a time in this country where we thought maybe it had become irrelevant, that it was just a golden, moldy oldie. It's got an all-new relevance. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save. We're the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me. Yeah, my blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. All the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to take grace and tell me. Yeah.
lovely interlude that was. Barry McGuire, of course, a classic. Eve of Destruction. Change a few of the place names, and well, nothing else has changed, has it? Yeah, this is Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. It will be followed by curl up into a fetal position and you know, hope for the best midnight. Just because it's another one of those Willie Loman, Arthur Miller moments, attention must be paid. The dateline for this story in the New York Times yesterday, Gaza City, the story of the Bakker boys, all cousins, children of Gaza fishermen. Come with me, and I will make you fishers of men. Boys will be boys. They're kind of tough to control sometimes. Doesn't matter if you're a Palestinian or a hillbilly or most anywhere in between. You ask a adolescent boy to stay in one place for 9 days, sooner or later he's going to get a little stir-crazy and sneak out no matter how smart the adults are. That's the way the New York Times explains it. The Bakker boys were young cousins, it says, and they'd been cooped up for 9 days because of the air war against the people of Gaza. So the Bakker boys snuck out and went to play down by the shore by a jetty when the Israeli Defense Forces decided to obliterate a shack. Yeah. Never mind. Well, the four Bakker boys, the first blast killed one of them. But just to make sure they got the job done, the Israelis pumped in another round. And the other three cousins ceased to have any problems on Earth ever again, too. The New York Times reports there was a second blast and three more bodies littered the sand. One was charred, missing a leg, and another lay motionless, his curly head intact, his legs splayed at unnatural angles. The Israeli military acknowledged later that it had launched the strike, which it said was aimed at Hamas militants, and called the civilian deaths a tragic outcome. Too bad. It's like the IDF is just Alex Trebek. Aw, too bad. The New York Times going to great pains to report that Israel's military says it takes extensive precautions. You know, like when they call up, when the IDF calls up and says, "Hey, lady, do you speak Hebrew?" "Yeah, we're bombing your house in 5 minutes." "I will never be able to get my babies together and get them down the seven flights of stairs in 5 minutes." "Sucks for you. Bye now." Israel's military says it takes extensive precautions to avoid killing civilians and that it does not deliberately target them. But it has said, and you know, we got to give them a pass because of this, that, well, about half the people we've killed so far were not in any way involved in terrorism. Sucks to be them. But that's what happens when you're, you know, when God is on our side, you know, right? F-16 aircraft, airstrikes, missiles fired from Apache helicopters. Hey, wait, Apache helicopters? Isn't that trademark infringement? Because, I mean, don't we call our attack helicopters Apache helicopters and the Israelis are calling theirs Apache helicopters? Oh, no, oh, oh, dear. shelling from naval gunboats. Yeah. Oh, well. These things happen. And if God didn't want the Israelis to shell them, he would not have made them Palestinians. See how religion works? Yeah, I was directed to this update. Thank you. Thank you, Marty. I've got some audio here. Let's check it out. Going back to the question of causation of the downing, the attack on, please, let's throw away the weasel language, the naked, brutal, aggressive attack on a civilian airliner. Maybe I've got some audio. Oh, damn. Everything's in Cyrillic.
Только что сбили самолет, группа минера за Янакиева упал.
Летчики, летчики.
Поехали искать и фотографировать сбитый самолет.
Дымится, сколько минут назад?
Ну, 30 минут назад где-то.
Got any Russian speakers out there?
Да, майор.
Значит, это Чернухинские сбили самолет. Через Чернухинского блокпоста. Казаки, что на Чернухина стоят.
Да, майор.
Значит, самолет рассыпался в воздухе в районе шахты Петропавловской. Первый 200-й. Нашли первого 200-го.
А я женщина. 200-й.
Да, гражданский. Да, Саша.
Ну что у вас там?
Короче, блин, стопудово гражданский борт.
Понятно. А этот как? Народу много там?
Да пиздец. Обломки прямо во дворы падали тут.
Так вот. Борт какой?
Да я еще пока не разобрался, потому что я не был возле основной части. Я только вот смотрю там, где начали первые тела падать. Там остатки внутренних кронштейнов, кресла, тела.
Понятно.
Вот так.
И вооружение есть что-нибудь?
И вообще ничего. Гражданские вещи, медицинские ошметки, там полотенце такое, туалетная бумага.
Документы есть?
Да. Индонезийского студента есть из университета Томпсона, блядь.
По самолету, сбитому в районе Снежного Тереза.
Ну?
Это оказался пассажирский. Упал в районе Грабова, там море трупов, женщины, дети. Сейчас казаки там смотрят это все дело. По телевизору передают, вроде бы как этот, Ан-26 украинский, ну, транспортник. Но, говорят, написано на нем малазийские авиалинии. И что он делал на территории Украины?
Ну, значит, завозили шпиона у них, нахуй. Понял? Нехуй не дать, сейчас война идет, блядь.
Понял.
That is, according to what's being reported, an intercepted telephone conversation between Igor Bezler, who is identified as a Russian military intelligence officer and leading commander of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. In other words, he's one of the rebels. And he is reporting to a colonel in the main intelligence department that's of the Russian Federation Armed Forces, identified as Vasily Garanin. Then there's obviously a second downed or a second intercepted phone call between someone codenamed Major and someone codenamed Greek. The translation is as follows. Pilots, where are the pilots? Oh, no, I'm sorry. We have just shot down a plane, Group Minera. It fell down beyond Yanakievo. That's in Donetsk Oblast. Pilots, where are the pilots? Gone to search for and photograph the plane. It's smoking. How many minutes ago? About 30 minutes ago. Then Major says, these are Chernukin folks who shot down the plane. From the Chernukin checkpoint, those Cossacks who are based in Chernukino. Then Greek says, yes, Major. Major says, the plane fell apart in the air in the area of Petropavlovskaya mine. Oh, near a coal mine. Son of a bitch. The first 200, that's the code word for a dead person, we found the first 200, a civilian. Then Greek says, well, what do you have there? Major says, in short, it was 100% a passenger aircraft. note coming in from Horst. Subject line, IDF non-apology apology. We apologize to any individuals who feel as though carelessly existing in our meticulously controlled strike zone has unfairly deprived them of life and or limb, and their little family members and people over there, too. We didn't do anything wrong, but if anyone takes offense at being killed by us, we're genuinely sorry they feel that way. There we go. Shorty in L.A. noting, most U.S. flights do not fly over hostile areas. Some other countries do. Fact, if a commercial civilian passenger plane flight plan is routed and or scheduled through a conflict area, there's something called Shorty says from my memory, my Air Force years, a flyover code is given to the flight and becomes part of the manifest. The countries being flown over will have that manifest long before the flight reaches its area. This allows the pilot and aircraft pattern to be public. The pilot does not have to request entry into that airspace. My point is, then both Russia and the Ukraine were aware of that flight plan because they both had a copy of the manifest before that flight entered their airspace. Ooh, that kind of takes a little bit of the shine off of the oopsie defense. That great big Boeing, but we were quite sure that great big Boeing 777 was a crappy Ukrainian troop transport argument. It's kind of difficult to move on to the usual parade of ignorance and stupidity that attends the usual watch on the right-wing weirdos. By the way, note coming in regard to Juanita's note earlier. Note coming in from Kate. Hello, Juanita. I've missed you. Call in sometime. You're in my heart, sister. Kate in Montana now. Isn't that neat the way the family works here? Little family commune congregation. In the chat room, C.A. Sykes says, Bob, couldn't they just send them some pizza coupons like that industry did a while back? Yeah, wasn't that Frackers that was giving out free pizza in exchange for, yeah. And a little conversation going on in the chat room, which you are welcome to pop in on. Good evening to Anatole, to Bean, to C.A. Sykes, to Devin, to H.C., to Jug of Punch, Mr. Gibson, Riator, Sentient, Stockton Larry, Texas T, and Tim from L.A. Of course, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderators Sparky and Lottie are on the case. Yeah, Jug of Punch reminds me that Netroots Nation has kicked off up in Detroit. It would have been fun to be up there. But it's, the wherewithal we once had to send the horn there and do advocacy work for mountaintop removal has long since dried up. So here we sit. Yeah, Jagapanch and I were both at Netroots Nation in Pittsburgh. I remember it well. We were the. Did you know? Just a little bit of stupid trivia. Did you know that the Horn was the first outfit ever to live stream Netroots Nation panels and plenary sessions? Because we were. We really were. And by the next year, they'd caught on and said, hey, you know, that's probably a pretty good idea. So I'm guessing, let me look here. Hey, yeah. Yeah, they're putting out video now. They've got a live stream. They've got a live stream going out. You can find their schedule. The opening keynote was at 7:15, about an hour ago. Their broadcast schedule is right there on the website. Looks like they're having a fine old time up in Detroit. Good for them. Where else? Yeah, sooner or later we're going to have to talk about some of the everyday ordinary lunacy. So why the hell not? Let's do a little bit of a follow up. Oh no, let's go to the phones instead. We have Larry calling in. Hey Larry.
Hi Bob, how are you?
I'm great. You sound great, man.
Thank you.
You always have such awesome audio.
Thank you. It's because I'm on my iPad. It was good to hear Edward today because I haven't heard Edward in a long time. And I always think about him whenever we have our Skype chats, and I could never remember his name, but it was really good to hear from him.
Oh, Edward from Dallas?
Yes. Yeah, and I always love to hear from Devin. You know, Devin's in our chats too, and he always gives us some really good advice. Everything, which is really nice to hear. I just thought I would call in and say hello, and I miss everyone, and I'm here. I'm really upset with Israel right now. I don't hate Israel necessarily. I don't hate those people.
Nor do I.
But I certainly hate their policies, and everything. I was at the Democratic Party meeting last weekend, as I mentioned, that I was going to go there for a few hours, and I did. And they have some propositions. One is to raise malpractice, you know, so people can make money from doctors doing malpractice. And the other one has to do with the insurance commissioner in this state being able to regulate the insurance companies, and those were the big issues. I talked with the political director of the Democratic Party, who lives in Chico, really close to Dunk, and he's been there for a long time, and I mentioned mountaintop removal at the same time that I was signing a petition for the California Disclose Act, and the Disclose Act says that what they want is they want the funders for each of these initiatives or propositions that go on the ballot, they want to name those particular funders so you know which corporate interests or which political interests or which PACs are behind whatever initiative so they can trace the money.
Oh, wow. The Supreme Court will the rats in Washington will bounce that so fast it won't know what happened.
Well, it's the California Clean Money Campaign, and it's Trent Lang from Los Angeles that's doing it. The CMA, the California Medical Association, was very much against the 46 or the to raise medical malpractice fees. They called the medical malpractice fees that those are non-economic damages, and they're going to hurt. It's going to hurt the care for people with disabilities and elderly folks, because if doctors have to pay more money for malpractice, even though at the front end of the initiative it talks about doctors being tested for drugs and things like that, that's what they're using to hook people. But the real issue is the malpractice piece of it. Although the people that are in favor of the proposition don't talk about that. They talk about the drug testing. That's what's happening. And I talked to Bob Mulholland, and Bob said, Larry, if you bring up mountaintop removal, there's so much going on and they're so focused on these propositions. Nobody's going to be willing to listen to you talk about it. He also kind of poo-pooed the Disclose Act, because he said, he told the person who was getting the signatures, he said, remember McCain-Feingold? And then Bob said, you know, I was against McCain-Feingold. So, you know, this is what happened at the meeting. Other than that, I enjoyed seeing some old friends, but the Democratic Party, the Cal Democratic Party, as nice as some of those people are, it's hopelessly conservative right now. I mean, I'm sorry, Bob, but it really is.
Really?
Yeah.
Or the people running the show are.
And I don't have any other states to compare it with. I hear that the California Democratic Party is probably the most liberal Democratic Party in the nation. I don't know. I can't compare it with any of the other states. And I talked to somebody about mountaintop removal, and he said, well, if you go up to Oregon right now, they have places in Oregon that are just as badly environmentally affected as places in West Virginia.
May I dare say bullshit?
Okay, fine. All right.
No, I mean, I know other places have their own, their own problems with predatory extraction and timbering and so forth. But what's been going on here has been going on for so long that nothing can compare. I mean, we've got old mines that are still leaking acid mine drainage from 100 years ago, Larry.
Yes, I understand. And you know, I'm not the, you know, I'd love to be able to try to turn things around. I think, you know, I hope we can, but some of my friends in the chat room yesterday said, Larry, you keep on asking the same questions over and over again, and if you keep on asking the same questions over again and you get the same answer and you know what the answer is, then you have to stop asking the questions. That's all that, you know, that's all that there is to it. And it was suggested to me, and I don't want to name names, they know who they are. They said, you know, I said, Mike and Bob talk about the same things and get frustrated. And they said, but Larry, they're paid to talk. And furthermore, and furthermore, they know how to make a logical progression between points, between A to B. And you have a really hard time doing that. You go from A to Q or A to Z and then back to C and then back over to E. And you just ramble like crazy. So just, you need to learn how not to ramble. You need to learn how to be succinct and not drive, you know what I'm saying. I don't know.
Don't let it get under your skin. No, the only reason I laughed, Larry, was that whoever said that I'm paid to do this is, they don't know much about how this works here.
I think what they meant, I think they didn't say paid. That those aren't the words that they use. But they said it's in the profession of doing talk, and being a facilitator and trying to get a point across. That's you know your choice in life is to try to galvanize, try to galvanize people to do something and to try to get them to be interested in what you're talking about, but that you and Mike know how to get from point A to point B and know how to make a clear point, and you don't beat around the bush. So
I get
anyway,
you.
I'm sorry, but
well, no, you have nothing to apologize for.
Yeah. So the point is I'm frustrated. I'll get over this stuff, and you know, everybody in the chat room and everybody on the call, I all consider you part of my family, or I'll consider you my family. So if you all gotta, you know, so that's what that is. But I am frustrated with the Democratic Party because they're hopelessly moderately to the, you know, they're moderate to right wing, and they don't. And the Progressive Caucus didn't seem that big to me the last time, and the Lesbian Gay Caucus was really small. Usually, I don't usually, you know, go in there. My city council person was there, Chris Worthington, who's a wonderful person who's been under attack in Berkeley because he is so liberal and he is so caring and stuff. They've been trying to run various people, other lesbian and gay candidates against him for years, and Chris is wonderful, I think, and he's just a wonderful human being, and if he disagrees, he'll tell you that he disagrees, but he always does it in a respectful way, and I need to learn how to not play people against each other and not get wrapped up in these things. You know, everybody in the chat.
You've just proven to me, Larry.
Yeah.
Sincere. And that you're actually working and trying to go from one day to the next and be a better human on day two than you were on day one, and a better human on day three than day two. And you know what? That's all any of us can ask of any other human on this planet.
Well, I talked to somebody yesterday. I said, why is it that the people in the South and people are so against, they talk about, you know, they're against gay and lesbian folks. And they said, because deep down, they're fearful that they might be gay or lesbian themselves, and they don't want to face that fact. So they want to convince everybody to believe the way that they believe, because they're not sure that they believe what they believe. So they,
you know, you're right. You just brought something to mind. Like I said earlier today, Larry, I was I went over and had a little sit down with Dr. Bill to talk about a couple of things, deal with some computer issues and stuff earlier today, and on the way back, I had I had the radio on, and I had it tuned over to NPR, and I was listening to Terry Gross and what you said about people being afraid that they might be LGBTQQQ resonated with me, because Terry Gross on Fresh Air, which we get at 3 o'clock in the afternoon here in Almost Level, was interviewing three of the authors of a new book called Trans Bodies, Trans Selves, which is a take on the magnificent work in a book called Our Bodies, Ourselves, of a previous generation.
Yes,
a book for women to come, you know, just, you know, to have a safe space to consider the workings of their own bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And so now there's a similar book out. And I got to tell you, I was a little put off by Terry Gross. And this is not me just looking for somebody to pick on. It's not. Most of the time I enjoy her interviews. I enjoyed this one. It was enlightening. But of all the people to ask, and then again, you know, maybe it's not the wrong thing to do, but to ask simplistic people or simplistic questions of people who have faced really, really complex issues of personal autonomy, like what was one of the questions? Okay, here's a gender-born woman. Mm-hmm. Asking a trans woman why, you know, what it felt like to want to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And just, there was some, anybody who wants to hear it can probably go and listen to it, but it just struck me as being, you know, what? I mean, let's talk about the real world crises trans people face in this world. You know, the beatings, the muggings, the rapes, the manifest horrors, the simple, and she did get into, and she asked that question that every trans person or every gay person apparently has to get asked.
Mm-hmm.
When did you realize you were? And I just thought, you know, I was hoping that one of the three would say, well, Jesus, Terry, when did you realize you weren't or you were? I mean, why do people who are not cisgendered?
Yes, cisgender.
Have to answer that question.
Yes.
Why is it, you know, well, you know, Terry, I was 5 years old and I saw the seams on mommy's stockings and, yeah, you know, bullshit. And I guess I'm being too rough on this, but there's got to be a better way of trying to be more welcoming and open to all segments of this society than to, I mean, would she say, tell me, Dr. King, when did you realize you were black?
Yeah, I understand. Well, if I were to ask Terry Gross that question, she would say, I know what Bob is saying, but I'm trying to play to my audience. And,
well, I hope it's not, you know, that. I hope this is not playing to the people beyond the footlights or, you know, out past the on-air sign. I don't know. I just babble into the microphone.
You know, it's like trying, like my asking my parents when I was younger, what is it like to walk? You know. Because I'm an embodied person who doesn't, and I'm wondering what is, you know, and this is the thing. It's like somebody who's able-bodied who has an empathy for somebody who is not able, you know, and they think that somehow there's a difference. It's like making a difference. Well, the reality is that there is a difference on a surface level. And there is, but underneath it all, we're all human beings.
Yeah, I mean, that line of questioning, Larry, and I'm not going to repeat the old joke, but that line of questioning from Terry Gross reminded me immediately of an old joke from a million years ago that's really insensitive, but points up the stupidity of lines of inquiry like that. I think I've wandered down an alley and found a brick wall at the end of it, and I don't know how to express what it is that was frustrating me. But we're fast approaching the end of the program. Stop it with the apologies, Larry.
Okay. I hear Mr. Stress soon. I haven't heard him for a while, so maybe he'll call in.
That's because you've been away, not because he's been.
Okay.
You take care, Larry.
All right. Thank you.
Bye now. Bye. Our buddy Larry calling from the Bay Area. A little bit of time left remaining in the program. Another note coming in from Shorty in L.A. On his Facebook page, a Dutch citizen named Cor Pan shared a photo of the plane he was about to board in Amsterdam with a caption that translates as, "If it disappears, this is what it looks like," regarding the Malaysia Airlines flight. And Shorty simply remarks, "All of this death and destruction on International Justice Day." And Juanito with an email says, "Tell Larry to be of good cheer. He speaks to me and for me. The Florida Democrats are horrendous too. Tell him to keep on saying whatever he wants to. Jesus said to keep on asking, seeking, and knocking to the point of making a pest of yourself if that's what it takes." Thank you, Juanita. You've got a mighty good spirit. It is about 15 minutes before the hour, and if you want to get, we got room enough to get in a phone call or two. If you want to jump in, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178. And at this point in time, I would be remiss with 15 minutes remaining in the program to note, if I did not note, that what I thought was going to be a fairly simple matter of just raising $85 to keep up with fundraising instead of $150 has turned into a Herculean event because we are at zero. Yeah, so instead of being able to just say, hey, we're going to move into Friday, okay. No, it looks like we're going to move into Friday in something like a $235 to go. Let's see. Let's go to the phones. Yeah, look, if you want to keep it from being a zero night, the PayPal button's ahead on RadioNetwork.com, and maybe you'll get some help and some company. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes.
This is Dave.
Hey, Dave, what's happening?
How are you?
I'm well.
Oh, I just, I'm so sorry about which went down. I was looking at the pictures earlier today, and it was so ugly. War is so ugly.
Civilian massacres being particularly ugly, whether they happen in the Ukraine or in Gaza.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, you were having a conversation with Devin a bit earlier today, and, I couldn't believe it because you were referencing a time period and an event which I had been reading about earlier in the day, which was that volcanic eruption which wiped out
Thera and the Minoan civilization.
Yeah, it also I actually was reading about it was in 1400 BC.
Yeah, thereabouts.
And I was reading about how it wiped out all these military of the Egyptians too, and I've gotten into this thing. I'm converting to a new religion. It's actually not a new religion. It's an ancient religion. It's Atenism. Are you familiar with that? I think you would be.
I don't know about specific work on what it did to the Egyptians. It had to have an impact. But what it did to the Minoan civilization on Crete itself is stunning. There is detritus from a tsunami that runs 100 yards up a cliff, or 100 feet up a cliff.
Well, they're actually saying that it may have been associated with the plagues of Egypt that they reference in the Bible too. Because
I won't go there, Dave. I will not go out there.
I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying that's
because
what I read.
every time somebody unearths a pottery shard in that region of the world, there's some biblical archaeologist who says, "Well, see, it shows that the Bible is real."
Sure, absolutely. But actually, it coincides with. Are you familiar with Akhenaten?
Akhenaten.
Okay,
yeah.
Everyone, he's one of the most famous ones. And he was, they have just proved through DNA evidence that the mummy they believed to be Akhenaten was the father of Tutankhamun.
Tutankhamun was the successor to Akhenaten. And part of the reason he got such a lavish send-off when he died at the tender age of 18... having done nothing in the way of a pharaonic career, the one thing he did do was to restore the old Egyptian polytheistic religion away from the monotheistic one that Akhenaten had tried to impose and completely upset the social structure in the land of Khem. Remember,
right.
The Greeks invented the word Egypt. The Egyptians themselves referred to themselves as being in the land of Khem, K-E-M.
Right. I'm just learning a lot about this. I'm glad to talk to you because it sounds like you know a lot more about it than I was talking to Malloy about it last night, and he Googled Atenism during the break. The show went to break.
And I heard
came
it.
Back and he goes, "Oh wow, this is incredible," because all kinds of people have many historians have said that Akhenaten was one of the first monotheists. Sigmund Freud wrote a book about him, actually, and it's really interesting stuff.
But Freud's stuff is largely speculative because there was a whole lot of missing data then that we have now that Freud didn't have access to.
Yes, But it's fascinating because it's basically worship of the light of the sun. What it is, it's reverence and worship to the light of the sun.
Yeah, the Aten was the disk of the sun, right?
Right, right, and it's awesome. I'm going to start a new.
It can also be understood, Dave, as a radical counter response to a culture in which the priestly class had obtained what Akhenaten thought was way too much control over the population to the point that it rivaled. Rivaled Pharaoh's control.
Oh, that's an awesome perspective that you're throwing out there. That's perfect for today, then.
And so consequently, there were a whole bunch of out of work priests who were used to living pretty damned high on the crocodile or hippopotamus or whatever, and they were extremely put out. So that when Akhenaten met his mortal end, and the young boy King Tutankhamun said, "Well, sure, let the priests back in and put the statues back up," the first thing they did was go around to all the stuff that Akhenaten had built and start scrubbing out his scrubbing out all his self references from his steles and stelae and hieroglyphics and everything. The Romans went on to do it too, and they had a name for it. I think it's called Damnatio Mori.
Damnation of death. He was obliterated from the list of the pharaohs. Mm-hmm. But that's the amazing thing, because it's the ironic thing is that's one of the reasons why they found the tomb of Tutankhamun almost fully intact, because his name had been obliterated and he'd been forgotten. His name had been obliterated from the list. And
oh no,
forgotten.
No! Tutankhamun was not obliterated. Akhenaten was.
No, he was too. Tutankhamun was too. He was.
I read it in a couple of
sources. Actually, there was they're saying there may have been an intermediary pharaoh between Akhenaten and Tutankhamun, which was Snitkarke or something like that, who they think may have been Akhenaten's brother. But it's really interesting. Read up on it, and you can clear me up on it, or you can confirm that. But I was reading that today, and it's actually Tutankhamun's real first name had been Tutankhaten, and he had changed it to Tutankhamun when he restated
Amun,
Amun.
Amun versus Aten, right?
Exactly. Aten was a revolutionary and labeled heretic cult.
But then again, the last thing this planet needs is one more monotheistic religion.
Well, this is the sun. The sun is real.
Yeah, but so is monotheism. And anytime you get an opportunity to say, "My God's the right God and your God's the wrong God," that's where the trouble comes from. I mean, anywhere, all through history, you find a bunch of people worshiping one God and insisting that's the real God. It's like ripples out of a pond. There's nothing but trouble. But Dave, I'm gonna roll along. So hopefully we can work in one more phone call, because about three people called at the time that I got you. Thanks a lot, Dave. Have a good evening.
Talk to you soon.
Bye now.
All right, bye bye.
Calling from Oregon. That is Dave. If you want to try to work in one more call, that'd be, you're more than welcome to do it, and we'll run it right up to the very edge of the end of the program. Thank you to Sal and Thomas and Robert and Jay Cruzen. We've gone from an $85 hole to a $45 hole. Thank you to the four of you. You have no idea what it means to not have deficits going from one program to the next. Thank you so very, very much. So if you were trying to get in to the conversation, you're welcome. You're welcome to try. And by the way, just what I said about that particular Terry Gross interview. Don't they put that up so you can listen to it somewhat later? What's the name of the Terry Gross program? 20 Questions or what is it? Somebody will know. You know, look up Terry Gross. Um, And let me know. I mean, if I got it wrong, you know, you're free to. You're free to let me know. So I guess we have pretty much come to the end of the program this evening, and there's so much more to get to. But this day just kind of went down the toilet with the news of the civilian massacre and the airliner and the civilian massacre in Gaza. Oh, civilian massacres. Lord. But I got a feeling the first hour or so of Friday on the Front Porch is going to be a real Lulu. Because I got a stack here that I'll be a month of Sundays getting through. So you might want to make sure that you're on board for tomorrow's Friday on the Front Porch. And just as a reminder, if you want to participate in Friday on the Front Porch, all you need, we can't use the dial-in phone number. We have to use the Skype-to-Skype thing because of the way Skype groups work. You can send a contact request to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, Sparky Dunk, at Skype, and he'll friend up with you, and you can join in the roundtable conversation of extraordinary, ordinary Americans that is Friday on the Front Porch. Thank you, Bill. Bill in Montana. Fresh air. Yes. See, there's that brain cell thing going on again. I've been listening to Fresh Air for, I think Terry Gross did her first one when she was like, you know, six, and I think I've been listening that long. Off and on, and for the life of me, I could not pull that. Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much. Let's wrap it up and take it home. Again, thanks to Jay Cruz and Sal and Thomas and Robert for throwing a few spadefuls in on the hole that we had worked ourselves inadvertently into. I thought this was going to be easy. We've got $45 to go if you want to fill it the rest of the way up, so we've just got our regular $150 to deal with tomorrow night. Thanks to all of you in every way that you participate. If you want some good reading, Ed Rabel is a fine writer, and you can go to Amazon and look for his new book. You will find it fascinating. Again, the title of it, Black Gold, Black Death. Black Gold, Black Death. You can find it at Amazon if you're not here in the West Virginia area or in the Valley. I'm going to try to go meet Ed on July the 26th down in Charleston. That'd be awful fun. But you can order the book at Amazon.com. And if anybody asks you, just tell folks about his candidacy. And a note going out from James to Larry. Tell Larry to talk to the Rural Caucus. They get ignored at the California Democratic Party all the time, but may be natural allies who may want to help. And when he does, tell him James said hello. Thanks, James. Appreciate it. So however it is that you participate in the program, thank you. Thank you very kindly. You are the ones who make this community a community, not me. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy, moderators in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox, going hard at it, hammer and tongs in Australia. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.